Ladies and gentlemen, this afternoon's winner in the Politicians Having Tough Days sweepstakes, it's British Prime Minister Theresa May.
I've listened very carefully to what has been said in this chamber and out of it.
Yeah, you know who's not laughing at Brexit? British bankers, that's who. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rosedahl. Monday, today, December the 10th. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We are going to play just a little bit more from Prime Minister May's speech in Parliament today, announcing that the big Brexit vote she had scheduled for tomorrow, well, that's just not going to happen.
From listening to those views, it is clear that while there is broad support for many of the key aspects of the deal, on one issue, the Northern Ireland backstop, there remains widespread and deep concern.
So May read the handwriting on the wall.
As a result, if we went ahead and held the vote tomorrow, the deal would be rejected by a significant margin. We will therefore defer the vote scheduled for tomorrow and not proceed to divide the House at this time.
I love the guy who just screamed, right? Anyway, pundits, of course, we're watching closely. Markets as well. The pound, in fact, lost 1.3% against the dollar today as the future of the British economy looked anything but certain. Also, keeping a keen eye on things, the traders and dealers, the analysts and managers, the investors and the proprietors of Britain's richest industry, finance, who risk being shut out of some European markets when or perhaps if Brexit actually does happen. Marketplace's Stephen Beard went to the heart of British finance, the city it's called, sometimes the square mile as well. He went to check the mood.
While the Brexit debate has raged in Parliament, the city, 2 miles downriver, has remained rather quiet. The bankers, brokers and dealers who bustle here are overwhelmingly in favour of EU membership. But, says City Grandee Sir Mark Boliat, it's been prudent for Britain's most prosperous but unloved industry to say little about Brexit.
People still blame the financial services industry, and quite rightly too, for the crisis. And if there's a view this is bad for the banking industry, people will say, the bankers are leaving, great, we'll drive them to the airport.
But the city, he says, supports 1/3 of 1 million mostly well-paid jobs and pays more than $90 billion a year in taxes, more than 10% of the UK budget. Brexit puts that in jeopardy.
For Britain, it really is a massive self-inflicted wound where we're working desperately hard to make ourselves poorer.
The city doesn't look any poorer. Jackhammers still echo across the square mile and cranes dot the skyline. Wine bars and restaurants are still jam-packed. But these finance workers, quaffing beer and wine at eye-watering prices and speaking on condition of anonymity, admit they're worried about Brexit.
Is there going to still be freedom of services? Are we still going to be able to transact European business? So there's a lot of unanswered questions for us.
I can't really see it being much of an opportunity. It's definitely more of a risk. I would be concerned, particularly in the event of a no-deal scenario.
You would be a bit nervous about your own prospects?
Potentially, yes. The bottom line is I think the city will carry on, however its role in Europe and in the world as a global financial centre will be diminished.
Big financial firms with their European headquarters in London have been setting up additional operations in rival centres like Frankfurt and Paris to ensure continuing access to the EU. But there haven't been major job losses here. A river of money is still flowing through the city. London remains by far the biggest foreign currency market in the world and a really big player in capital raising and trading. Daniel Hodson is former head of the Life Futures Exchange. He says London is safe. The EU needs access to the city.
You can't take markets and move them lock and stock like you might be able to move the production of motor cars or something like that from A to B, from country A to country B. You can't do that with liquidity.
Hodson is one of the few city grandees to publicly support Brexit.
I believe the city would be better off. I think there are all sorts of restrictive things which have happened to the city in the last few years, particularly in terms of regulation, which would be much better handled if we were outside the EU.
And economist Andrew Hilton, who's run the CSFI think tank here for 25 years, says London remains a great place for business and pleasure, easily outpacing those rival European centres.
We're not quite as unpredictable as the French in particular. We're not quite as boring as the Germans. Everybody says, my God, Frankfurt, you want to go to Frankfurt? It closes on Thursday.
Sir Mark Boliat, who favours remaining in the EU, says this is whistling in the wind. Brexit may not trigger a mass exodus from London, but it will ensure the long-term decline of this financial centre, and the cost will be counted in the jobs not created here.
Longer term, we think it could be as many as 75,000 people who will not be employed who otherwise would have been, and that's a massive tax loss to the British government as well.
Today's shock decision to postpone tomorrow's vote on the withdrawal agreement has breathed new hope into the Remainers. Many in the city may well be celebrating, but quietly, behind closed doors. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
The Bank of England said the other day that a grim economic future is in store for the Brits if Brexit does happen. It's that whole you weaken your ties to the global economy at your own peril thing. The outgoing chief economist at the International Monetary Fund has a corollary. Maurice Obstfeld said this weekend that global economic growth is going to slow next year and that is going to take a bit of the wind out of the American economy. In other words, despite all the America First rhetoric and increasingly nationalistic economic policies, the United States is still part of a larger economic whole. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson has that one.
No man is an island entire of itself. And same goes for economies. The U.S. has a big domestic economy, less reliant on the world outside its borders than many other countries, but still no island. Bart Van Ark is chief economist at the Conference Board, a business research organization.
The U.S. is still trading very intensively with other countries around the world. And, you know, U.S. companies are investing abroad, and so do foreign companies that invest in the United States. You know, the U.S. is very exposed, of course, financially, and other countries are exposed to the U.S.
In fact, Brian Nick, chief investment strategist for the financial firm Nuveen, says the U.S. has actually increased its economic ties with the rest of the world over the last year, despite putting tariffs on many imports.
Whatever dampening effect that might have on global trade has been swamped by the fact that we are borrowing even more from overseas and we are spending even more on imports than we were this time last year.
So if other countries aren't growing as fast, we'll feel it in the U.S. Less healthy economies will buy fewer American products and services. Ann Owen, a professor of economics at Hamilton College, says we got a sneak peek last quarter of how that can impact economic growth.
The decline in exports that we had in that quarter actually took a half a percentage point off of our GDP growth. So our GDP growth would have been 4% if we had not had a decline in exports.
Owen says if global growth slows next year, we can expect even less demand for U.S. goods, which will eventually impact U.S. jobs. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Speaking of a global economy, some measurable part of its future spent a second day in a courtroom in Vancouver, Canada today. The bail hearing for the CFO of the Chinese telecommunications conglomerate Huawei is still in session. Meng Wanzhou's lawyers agreed today to put up $15 million, that's Canadian, as a bond. The judge said he is still thinking things over. On Wall Street today, down hard, then up at the close. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We did a story last week, the news peg of which was that the ride-sharing company Lyft had filed to go public and, in so doing, ahead of much bigger rival Uber, hoped to get the IPO upper hand. Yeah, well, not so fast. Lyft. Uber filed its own papers Friday afternoon. Rumor has it that investors are going to be able to buy into both companies as early as March. But what exactly is the prize that awaits the first to the IPO finish line? Marketplace's Jed Kim has that one.
This IPO race is interesting because it's one of those rare cases of a flag being planted on a brand new industry, ride-hailing apps. You might even call it an initial public offering. Did I just make that up?
I actually haven't heard that.
Matt Kennedy is an IPO market strategist at Renaissance Capital. He says being the first company to an IPO lets them build up a lot of buzz, which could play well with some people looking to invest in ride-sharing.
They'll buy whichever one comes first. But I also don't want to overstate its importance. Regardless of which one comes first or second, I think both are going to get a huge amount of interest.
He says what's potentially more significant is the ability to set the valuation for the companies.
If you've got a certain target in mind that you think you can get, maybe the first one can get it and the second one will just be at the whim of the market.
The valuation will depend on the companies themselves, which are actually pretty different despite always being lumped together as ride-hailing apps. Uber is more of a mobility company. It's going to sell investors on its popular Uber Eats business and on offshoots into scooters and bikes, not just in the US, but globally. Lyft has some of those things, but it's more focused on growing its taxi hailing business in the US. Jay Ritter teaches corporate finance at the University of Florida. He says the hullabaloo over who's first to an IPO goes away eventually.
In the long run, what matters is, does the company execute its business model?
Ritter says for these companies so far, they've focused on signing up loyal users. And that's been right in line with the demands from early investors.
Both Lyft and Uber are fighting for market share, and they've been focusing on growth rather than short-term profits.
But a lot of potential investors are going to want to see that the companies will actually turn a profit soon. I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
As we catch our collective breath before the 2020 campaigns really get going, and yes, I know they've kind of already started, but work with me here. It is worth taking a look back at one of the big winners in November's midterms, public health insurance coverage, specifically expansion of Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act. Three conservative states, Idaho, Nebraska, and Utah, passed ballot measures expanding their programs, and two other states elected governors who've said they will push for that expansion. Kansas is one of those two. And as Peggy Lowe reports now from KCUR, a lot of Kansans are hanging their hopes on that campaign pledge.
Amanda Dabrowski visited the Health Partnership Clinic in Olathe, Kansas at the end of November to sign up for Medicaid. She's had a tough year. Her husband died. She's disabled from a work injury, so she doesn't have a job. And she's caring for her 7-year-old daughter. Then on top of that, the clinic said she didn't qualify for Medicaid.
I make too much for Medicaid, but I don't make enough to get some assistance on the marketplace, on Obamacare. I don't understand how that happens.
Here's how that happens. Dabrowski was told that income from her and her daughter's Social Security placed her above the Medicaid eligibility limits. But her income was also below the limit for subsidies under the Affordable Care Act. She was in what's called the coverage gap. The more than 2 million low-income adults in the U.S. who fall into the gap that comes from states that have not expanded Medicaid.
I won't say what I really feel about it because I'm still pretty angry.
Dabrowski was told that if Kansas had a Medicaid expansion program, she'd probably get coverage. Despite Republican resistance during the past decade, Medicaid expansion could be passed in Kansas next year, thanks to a new governor. Democrat Laura Kelly even mentioned it during her victory speech on election night.
It's long past time to expand Medicaid. Yeah.
The state senator who gets sworn in January defeated Chris Kobach, a conservative Republican who opposed expansion. State research shows that covering an estimated 150,000 low-income residents could cost Kansas more than $100 million.
For Governor-elect Kelly, there you have a governor who both understands why the Medicaid expansion might be a good deal and important for the citizens of Kansas.
Diane Rowland is the top Medicaid expert at the Kaiser Family Foundation, a health policy research group. So far, 37 states have adopted Medicaid expansion. Rowland says states are at a tipping point on Medicaid expansion because voters said it was their top priority leading into the midterms.
We've seen in our polling that the public is much more aware now of the importance of Medicaid. More in the public have a connection to someone who has benefited from the Medicaid coverage.
But that doesn't mean it will be an easy sell for the new Kansas governor. Dan Hawkins, a Republican representative from Wichita, is fighting it. He says many states that passed the expansion are having trouble paying for it.
It doesn't stop hospitals from closing. It doesn't even solve the problem.
Governor-elect Kelly counters Medicaid expansion can pay for itself. She pointed to Louisiana, where that state's governor recently announced that it saved more than $300 million while creating some 19,000 jobs.
I can't, I won't bust the budget.
As of now, Amanda Dabrowski doesn't have any health insurance. She had quit her job at a Walmart distribution center because she injured her back and she couldn't work. She worries about how she'll pay for the spinal injections and other medications she takes for the pain. She found out she didn't qualify for Medicaid in late November, just days after the anniversary of her husband's death.
I just feel so defeated.
If Medicaid expansion is passed in Kansas, Dabrowski says she will run back to the clinic and get signed up. In Kansas City, I'm Peggy Lowe for Marketplace.
Coming up.
It's like this insta-industrial complex.
Influencing ain't as easy as it looks, you know. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 34 points today, a 0.1%, 24,423 for the blue chips. Although I must tell you, the Dow was off 507 at one point, so make of that what you will. The NASDAQ somehow found itself 51 points higher, nearly 0.75%, 7,020. The S&P 500 advanced 4 points, a 0.1%, 26,037. There was news today that Apple has lost a preliminary court fight in a Chinese court over a ban on the sale of older iPhone models and some operating system problems. Chip supplier Qualcomm had argued Apple infringed on its patent for certain phone features. Apple somehow still dialed up 0.6%. Qualcomm boosted nearly 2.25%. Here's some Brexit uncertainty updates. HSBC Financial Services Company withdrew 0.8%. Multinational Barclays slumped 0.6%. You're listening to Marketplace. We do more than the numbers here at Marketplace, you know. We tell the stories behind the numbers, stories of real people, of businesses, both big and small, and of the impact the economy has on each of us. Because you appreciate this kind of public service journalism, we're asking you to give something back. Please donate today at Marketplace.org, and your gift will go twice as far thanks to a dollar-for-dollar match from the Candida Fund.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Court TV is making a comeback. Cates Networks, it's part of the EW Scripps company, announced today it's bringing back the Legal Proceedings channel for another day in court. And yes, for those of you who may not have been paying close enough attention, yours truly included, Court TV has apparently been off the air for the past decade. So Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino looks at the challenges and the opportunities in the now booming business of crime time TV.
Court TV launched in 1991 and reached its peak later that decade, taking true crime courtroom drama into the mainstream.
The Menendez brothers on trial, the real story.
It's been a good week for the prosecution lawyers in the O.J. Simpson trial.
The toddler's own mother, Casey Anthony, charged with murder.
In 2008, Court TV was rebranded as True TV, which mostly airs goofy variations of caught-on-camera hijinks. If you didn't notice Court TV was gone, maybe that's because its brand of gavel-to-gavel coverage and true crime documentary is everywhere now.
There's never been higher consumer interest in the drama of true crime programming.
Cates Network CEO Jonathan Cates says that's why the time is right for a Court TV reboot. The network's new version will feature live courtroom proceedings, analysis, and documentaries tapping the channel's archives. But it's going to take a lot to distinguish it in what has become a crowded marketplace. Dominic Patton, TV critic for Deadline Hollywood, points out coverage of crime and trials has become big business for major networks and fodder for podcasts like Serial and documentary series like Netflix's Making a Murderer.
Is there much more competition than there was
before? Certainly.
But he says the channel still has a lot of name recognition somehow. The fact that many people didn't even notice Court TV had ceased to exist could mean it will be easier to regain audiences, despite the competition. But it's going to need to get a little lucky. It needs a blockbuster case to captivate public interest.
Ultimately, a CNN or an MSNBC or a Fox News or anybody else, they can't cover it wall to wall because the rest of the world is happening.
And with a seemingly endless stream of legal troubles hitting big-name politicians and entertainers in the Me Too era, he says the network will have plenty to cover when Court TV launches next spring. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
Instagram has more than a billion monthly active users, and some not small number of them are what are known as influencers, people with big follower numbers who monetize that follower count by, in theory, influencing the rest of us. It sounds easy, perhaps not so easy in reality. Brian Chen is the lead consumer technology writer for The New York Times, also a guy who, as it happens, tried to make it big on Instagram. Brian, welcome to the program.
Hey, good to be here.
So with the acknowledgement that this is a little bit of a goof, I guess. okay, maybe a lot of a goof. Why did you want to experiment with this?
So this all started out because my fiance and I, we both love our dog, who's a corgi, and we both love cooking. So we thought that if you combine these two audiences of foodies and dog lovers, then this is going to be an overnight success, right? This is going to be a huge viral sensation on the web. And we decided to give it a try. We didn't really want to make any money or anything. We just wanted to make people see our food and our dog as much as possible, because we love these two things so much.
But also the prospect of actually becoming an Instagram influencer could be remunerative, shall we say.
Right. But after 4 months of doing this, we had something like 300 followers, which is not very much.
That's terrible. Know? Not only is it not very much, it's terrible.
Yeah. Our average number of likes was about 50. And I brought in a professional photographer I know to give me a consult. And he said, well, you could try shooting at different angles, like be more creative. You could incorporate dog clothing, things like that.
But I mean, you did the whole thing, right? You tried buying followers, right? How did that work out for you?
Yeah. So eventually, when nothing was working, I caved into buying these followers. So I read on some obscure marketing blogs that said, if you really want to make it big on Instagram, the one and only time to buy followers is when you're small and you're starting out, because you want to build at least a medium-sized audience that makes you look more attractive to newcomers to your profile and will grow your audience. So I paid $19 to this weird website called Social 10X, which offers to boost your followers, right? And it gave me 2,500 followers, and it was just really eerie because, like, every second I was getting this new zombie follower, if you will. And so we continued trying to post on Cooking with Fat Max, thinking, like, well, this could help grow our audience.
Is that the handle, Cooking with Fat Max?
Yeah, it's called Cooking with Fat Max.
Just to get you the plug, because you'll get more followers after this airs, you know, right? I mean, the Times article got you a bunch of followers. You'll get more after this one.
Yeah, that's a side effect, yeah. We continued posting after getting the bots, and to our surprise, Kai, we got even fewer likes after that, and we were not getting any more followers. So this wasn't working either.
So look, the moral of the story here is that being an Instagram influencer, or I imagine some kind of social media influencer at all, barring, you know, the big celebrities to begin with, it actually is hard work.
It's extremely hard work. So in the end, I interviewed this marketing company that gave me some advice. And they said, like, you have to go at this like it's a full-time job. No shortcuts, you know? There are tons of famous dog owners on Instagram. And that's why I thought it would be easy for me to get in, because, like, I thought, you know, I'm biased, but I thought my dog was exceptionally cute. Corgis are trending on Instagram.
Here's the kicker, dude. From the Times article, here's the best comment. My honest opinion, your dog isn't that cute. And mixing dogs with fancy food isn't really appealing. So you kind of had two strikes against you, is all I'm saying.
Yeah, but like to your point, Kai, like, at the end of the day, right, like Instagram doesn't feel like this amateur hour kind of thing. It's like this Insta industrial complex, right?
Right.
Where
that's
only
exactly
the
it.
Professionals can succeed, yep. Right? You have to have this really serious setup. You have to invest so much money and have all this equipment. But I was not willing to do most of these things. I just wanted to take pictures of my dog and food and have some fun.
Brian Chan, he writes for the New York Times, consumer technology and all kinds of stuff. Dog's also on Instagram, by the way. Brian, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me, Clay.
This final note on the way out today, in which the symbolism very much matters. You know that statue of the little girl, Fearless Girl is her official name, that was put up in front of the big charging bull statue down near Wall Street a couple of years ago? Well, she has been moved a block or two. She was officially unveiled today in her new spot directly in front of the New York Stock Exchange, a girl staring down American capitalism itself, if you will. I'm pretty sure, by the way, that I've got a picture of my daughter with that statue. All right, we got to go. The Dow up 0.1% today. The NASDAQ up nearly 0.75%. S&P 500 up 0.1%. It was ugly early is all I'm going to tell you. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, Daniel Shin, and Phoebe Unterman. Our special projects desk is Tommy Andres and Eliza Mills. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our wealth and poverty desk. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.